as old as time. True as it can be.
Good morning and welcome to Jonesy, the show that brings you conversations with some of the most interesting people in the world of books, podcasts, radio, theater, music, and humor, guaranteed to entertain and enlighten. I'm the host of Jonesy, Ken Jones, no relation, by the way. On today's episode, we welcome Neil Cochran, author of the new novel, The Story of the 100 Promises, from Forest Avenue Press. Neil is a queer, trans author and artist. He writes speculative fiction and fantasy that centers queer characters overcoming obstacles and building families. He also writes and illustrates graphic novels. Neil has worked in and around the publishing industry since 2012 in the roles of editor, literary agent assistant, marketing director, and bookseller. In the words of writer Stephen Allred, Neil Cochran's The Story of the 100 Promises is set in a world where folk tales can come true, where magic can change lives, where a quest undertaken with a pure heart just might succeed. The book is an affirmation of the myriad ways of being a human and of the many forms that love takes when loosed from the confining bonds of a binary culture. Please join us for our conversation with Neil Cochran, which is already in progress. Neil, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Neil, the story of the 100 Promises is described as, quote, a loose retelling of the Beauty and the Beast, which is a fairy tale I think most of us know well from the 1991 Disney film, the animated version. And there was a live action version that Disney released in 2017 with Emma Watson. You were a fan of the animated version, but not the more recent released. What attracted you to one and disappointed you in the other?
I think that the first one, I was just like the right age cohort for that. I was only two when it came out, but I then like had gotten it purchased for me or something like that. And I started watching it as a toddler and in through my my youth. And so it kind of imprinted itself on my memory, I guess. I mentioned at my launch party that it was my absolute favorite, such that I wore the tape out and had to buy a new one.
Oh, that was on VHS at the time.
It was on VHS, so yes.
Pre-DVD.
Pre-DVD, and that one, so I think there's a big nostalgia factor to it, which I think also plays into why I wasn't as into the live action version. Not because they changed things necessarily, but because I mostly didn't understand the changes that they made. And I have to caveat all of this by saying it's just my opinion and my experience of the movie, but particularly as somebody who was also a fan of the Broadway musical, some of the songs were confusing to me. I was like, there are perfectly good solos and emotional songs in the Broadway version. So did you just not have the rights to those or something like that?
You also said at the Powell's launch, Neil, that after seeing the live action version, you started writing the book. So that was about 5 years ago. And you thought of a fascinating twist, a little different than the movie. What if Belle fell in love with the Enchantress instead of the Beast? For those who don't remember the movie, the Enchantress plays a small but absolutely critical role. She's the one who puts a curse on the prince, turns him into a beast. And he's a beast until he learns to love another person and earn her love in return. It's a heterosexual story. What led you to taking this path in your book?
I think that, I've been a fantasy fan since I was a kid, and particularly the role of magic in those kinds of worlds has always been really interesting to me. And I'm also a big fairy tale fan, just like from my own experience, but also from my undergrad experience. We did a lot of studying of fairy tales and Tolkien, J.R.R. Tolkien, alongside each other, because Tolkien was a folklorist in a lot of ways, and he was particularly interested in those kinds of cultural stories. And he has a whole essay that I don't know if it's called On Fairy Tales or something like that, but he has a wonderful, wonderful essay about the things that fairy tales do for us narratively, culturally. So that was always a big interest of mine. And I was interested in the Enchantress character as sort of a archetype that appears in many fairy tales. You know, there's always like a witch or a fairy or like
cast a spell,
something like that. There's always some kind of element like that. And I, my, the spark, the idea was sort of like, what if that's all the same person? Like what if it's one enchanter in all of these stories? And that was sort of the launch point for the manuscript.
You also mentioned something that was really interesting to me and I never thought about. In the Beauty and the Beast story, there's an element of the Stockholm syndrome where a captive falls in love with that person's captor. It's manifested itself in reality several times too, which is, I guess, how a hostage falls in love or has some affinity with the person taking them hostage. Belle, of course, falls in love with her captor, the Beast, but you wanted to remove this entirely from your book.
Yeah, I did. And I will once again plug the podcast You're Wrong About, which has an excellent episode about Stockholm Syndrome in the media and the way we think of it today. But like, really what it comes down to, I think, is that that is a trauma response to, you know, being in captivity or being held against your will. And I don't really see that as having a big place in a romantic story or a happy story. I tend to like those stories without coercion.
It kind of takes away from the romantic love aspect.
It does. You know, it's a power dynamic. And,
exactly.
You know, we're all already negotiating all kinds of power dynamics. And this is, of course, not to say that the two characters who fall in love in my book don't have particular dynamics to be aware of, but I just didn't think that it served the story. And so I wanted to try and come at it from a different angle.
Now, the book features queer and trans characters. So again, that's another departure from the traditional Beauty and the Beast tale. Of course, the Disney versions. Now, there's a writer, Kaylin Bayron. She published a YA novel called Cinderella is Dead. It's a retelling of the Cinderella story, except centered on a queer Black girl. And she has said, I came up in a time when Disney princesses were at their peak, but I just never saw any princesses that looked like me or the people in my family. I loved fairy tales. I loved Disney movies. But the message is that you don't belong, that this isn't for you. And so it's incredibly disheartening and sad and makes you feel excluded, makes you feel like you're on the outside looking in. Did you feel the same way, Neil? And was that an influence on the book?
Yeah, I think absolutely. There's a ton of scholarship on the way that Disney in particular has used queer coding to identify its villains. And that is a very common way to promote that kind of othering, even if you're not explicitly having queer people in your story and certainly not having your protagonists be explicitly queerphobic or hateful in that way. It's less noticeable in Beauty and the Beast, I think, than some of the other ones. The only character who is really kind of queer-coded is LeFou, who was made belatedly explicitly queer in the 2017 version. But, you know, Divine was the model for Ursula in The Little Mermaid. That's a really classic example. So for me, that all kind of feeds into your self-perception before you even kind of realize what's happening, especially if you, like me, grew up in a kind of rural area where like these topics, A, just didn't come up at all. So there was a kind of invisibility, or when they did, it was derisively. And that teaches a lot of people to hide, which I think is really contrary to so much of the Disney messaging of like being bold and standing up for yourself.
Except if you're queer.
Then
you're destined to be a villain, I guess, if you see enough of those movies.
Pretty much. But that's why so many of the newer movies, I really enjoyed the Maleficent movies with Angelina Jolie, for example, because of that, like, no, wait, we're actually going to like do some rehabilitating of this character.
Now, Kaylin's book is a YA novel, Cinderella is Dead, and most of the Disney movies, the cartoons, the animated ones are certainly directed towards children and their parents who take them to the movies or buy the VHS tape for them, the DVD. I interviewed the writer Todd Davies several years ago. She had a fantasy novel called Report to Megalopolis. And she described the book as a fairy tale. And she said, fairy tales are really true and they're important. Fairy tales are not just little children's stories or things to be exploited by Walt Disney. Now, your book is written primarily for an adult audience. So I'm thinking you and Todd are in agreement here, Neil.
Yes, absolutely. I think it's a C.S. Lewis quote that is something about how fairy tales show us that dragons can be defeated. Very loosely paraphrasing that. And I think that that is true. And I think that that is something that adults need just as much as children, especially because as we grow up, we are counseled to push so much of our uncertainty down. We feel like we're expected to know everything and be able to handle everything. And it's very rare that you find yourself in a situation where your community or the adults around you are allowing you to be unsure or vulnerable. And that is the root of many problems, in my estimation. And so the idea of using a fairy tale structure as a way to kind of let people access more of their vulnerability and to think about what they're afraid of, or to at least like even just to externalize the thing that they're afraid of and to feel that resolution as a kind of subconscious hope or strength, I think is really important.
Yeah, it's funny. When I was leaving your book launch at Powell's, I saw a big display, the latest Stephen King novel for adults, and it's called Fairy Tale. I haven't read it yet, so I don't know how the fairy tale aspect plays out in the book, but I just thought that was an interesting coincidence.
Yeah. Yeah, that was the first time I'd heard of that book, too.
Now, you include a series of brief fairy tales or folk tales in the book with titles like The Story of the Beauty and the Thorn and The Story of the Statue, and you weave these into the main narrative. It turns out they all have an element of truth to them in the context of the novel. And you said that you started writing these folk tales first before the main part of the book, the story itself.
Yeah, at least the part two, which is the backstory of the Enchanter. I wrote the folk tales before that part because I was sort of trying to come at it from a perspective of somebody who would be reading these folk tales, just like a random person in this culture, because I didn't want my version of the character to impact how I wrote the folk tales too much, because that's the thing about folk tales is they use archetypes and you don't get a lot of characterization, especially not of like the magical characters who are just there to like help the protagonist along. So I didn't want to know too much about the Enchanter's interior life when I was writing those.
I should ask, because you mentioned it before in regards to Tolkien, is there a difference? I've been using them almost interchangeably between fairy tales and folk tales.
There probably is. Kate Ristow, who you might know, is a folklorist in town here. She would probably be able to tell you the difference. Probably what I am talking about would mostly fall into the category of folktale, because that's the kind of story that I studied the morphology of in preparation for this book, but I do not know the material difference.
Well, your book kind of gives some insight into maybe how folktales develop. There's a reality in the book, and the folktales seem to be a story built up from them, even though often we see the folktale in the book before we see the reality that they reflect. I'm thinking, well, folktales certainly, fairy tales, even mythology, I think, is a lot like that. There's a flood that wipes out a town or a country, and all of a sudden you got the mythology of the Great Flood, and it's just exaggerated and fictionalized in a way, as a way of dealing with these things or conveying a story through generations.
Yeah,
it's amazing that you did that. I just really enjoyed that part of the book.
Thank you. I mean, I think that all history is narrative. Which is not, of course, to say that history isn't true, but everything we learn about the past is received. You know, somebody has shaped it for our consumption. And that's why I so enjoy projects like the 1619 Project and other efforts like that to expand the narrative and to fill in things that have been left behind or hidden or purposefully forgotten. And that was part of the agenda in this book, was to sort of examine the history as narrative and what happens depending on how you view pieces of that history and players in that history.
And there's the famous quote that history is written by the victors.
Yes.
by those in power. And you can certainly see that in modern day societies where I know Nazi Germany, Soviet Russia, it's happening in the US here, where mm-hmm. books are getting banned and certain subjects are not allowed to be taught in schools, especially Florida and Texas.
Yep.
You're listening to Jonesy on KBOO Community Radio. On today's show, we're talking with Neil Cochran, author of the new novel, The Story of the 100 Promises, from Forest Avenue Press. Now, at that same launch, Neil, you mentioned you saw two ways of writing fairy tales today. Mm-hmm. And we're not counting Disney here. They're adapting. One is the approach James Lapine took in the musical Into the Woods, telling what happened before and what happens after the fairy tale itself, or the best known mm-hmm. part of the fairy tale. And the other is retelling the story to focus on what resonates today, in effect, writing a more modern story that feels like a fairy tale. It seems to me you took both approaches in the book.
Yeah, I guess you could say that. One of the things that I am aiming to do in like all of my writing is to, I guess the way I should say it is that I'm not particularly interested in creating entirely new spaces for people like me and the kinds of people that I find interesting and worth paying attention to. There are writers out there who are doing that, and they're fantastic and admirable. But I am at core a hobbit, and so I want to be in the cozy, comfortable, familiar cultural landscape that we have. So I wanted to really find space for myself and people like me in this story. I wanted to insert myself into it. So in that way, I was retelling the fairy tale according to its plot beats as much as I could. But I also am always interested in the extra stuff, especially with fairy tales, because the way they're told is very much told, usually almost with like a narrator voice who is speaking specifically to you.
Yeah, you've captured that language perfectly in the book. Mm-hmm. I mean, it reads like a fairy tale, a modern fairy tale, but certainly the rhythm and the vocabulary.
Yeah, and that was very, very deliberate. My standard writing style is not nearly as florid.
I don't think so. Most of us aren't. You were doing the fairy tale form. Now, you talked about inserting yourself in the book, which actually leads well into my next question. One of the main characters is Darig. Darig is the counterpart to Beauty in Beauty and the Beast. Darig was born a girl, but made himself known as a boy on his 15th birthday. And the transformation from female to male was helped by a magic thorn from the Enchanter character, mm-hmm. also known as Merrigan in the book. But Darig's coming out, especially at 15, alienated his father, who was a wealthy shipping magnate in this small town. And I was wondering if there's an autobiographical element in the story about your father and coming out at a certain age.
My story is not like directly analogous to Dara's. It more reflects the emotional, let me see how I want to put this. My father and I have had a very cyclical relationship for my entire life, not because of me coming out as trans, but because of various other kinds of traumas and disagreements over his behavior and what I was and was not willing to tolerate. So like Dara, I have spent most of my mid-teen to adult life not in good communication with my father, just not for like that one reason. So it's more about the emotions there than the literal experience.
And you use that for the story, the emotional part, but mm-hmm. not the actual details of your life.
Yeah.
Now, that damaged relationship between Darrick and his father sets in motion the plot. After leaving home, Darrick returns 10 years later to find his father dying. But Darrick wants to ask his father why he was turned away for his gender change. So he seeks out the Enchanter, and this starts the quest to keep his father alive long enough to have that conversation. So the father-son relationship is crucial to the story. Mm-hmm. You've said that deciding on the trajectory of this relationship was the hardest part to write. Now, I would have thought the world building, a number of other things. What were the difficulties in deciding on that relationship?
Well, a big part of it is that I personally have a real hunger for family and for community. That's another part of my hobbit. existence. I really want that kind of closeness and support. And it's a constant source of pain that I don't have that the way I would want with my family. And some of it is because of trauma and bad experiences. Some of it is just because of modern life. You know, we're a lot more far flung from each other than families historically have been. So my father and I have had these back and forths, these cycles of talking and not talking. And my husband is always confused every time I talk about reaching out, because he has heard me talk about how this feels to me before, and he doesn't seem to, like Jan in the beginning of the book. Jan is another character. Or Sidra in the beginning of the book, Dara's best friend, doesn't understand why he's even contemplating going back to his family. And it's because there is a connection there, no matter what. And there's always a hope. One of the quotes in the book is that we're taught that parents love you unconditionally. And that is
not always
true. But you still have that lesson and you still have that hope. And so it's really, really hard to be the child of someone you feel has rejected you and you don't understand why.
Oh, it's very complex. I've asked several authors when they write about fathers in their books, because I have a somewhat complex relationship with my own father, and I have two sons, and I understand, there's so many dimensions to it. Even when you're trying to be gentle and kind and stuff, it could be taken the wrong way. There's so much in the world of literature, songs, movies about mm-hmm. that relationship. So I guess we don't need to rehash it too much. But I found it really beautiful, Neil, that you have the Darrick and his father relationship, but also the Enchanter, Merrigan, has a father. And American's father actually told Merrigan at one point to escape into the forest to avoid arrest. The kingdom had these laws on gender, and Merrigan is neither a man nor a woman, genderless. And later in the story, Merrigan says, "I miss my father. He was a kind man and he loved me. Mm-hmm. And I was driven away. I waited and waited for someone to change the law to make it safe for me to return. I never thought to send a message and welcome him to the forest. I loved him and he loved me. And yet I believe sincerely that our worlds were separated by an impassable wall. Not seeing them again, not even trying, is the greatest regret of my life." I just love that you included it. It's kind of a counterpoint to the Darrick father relationship. This is a loving relationship. It just has a very sad aspect to it because they haven't seen each other again.
Yeah, I mean, there are parental relationships for queer people, trans people that are animosity based. But then there are also ones where there's just a lack of understanding. There's just confusion. And there's a pain in that too, of feeling like you're not as close or that you don't understand each other. For Merrigan, it was a literal legal barrier, which I would not be surprised if some parents and children end up experiencing now if they, for example, live in a state that is passing all these draconian laws against gender affirming care for youth. And so maybe they go live with a family member who is in a more accommodating state.
Now, Neil, my next show, which is October 27th, is a preview of the upcoming Portland Book Festival in early November. Mm-hmm. I'll be talking with the festival director, Amanda Bullock. I want listeners to know that you'll be there in person. I mean, I know you're doing a lot of digital virtual appearances for the book, but this is Neil in person. Do you know when and where we can find you to say hello and get book signed?
Yes, my pop-up reading is going to be at 1215 on the first floor of the Modern and Contemporary Art Building. It's next to a sculpture called Tower.
Which you got to pick, right?
No. The festival assigned it based on my book. And I think that it is pretty evocative of the labyrinth, the stone labyrinth that we end up having in the book. So I think it's a good pairing. And it's not going to be just a normal reading. I'm going to have actors performing
one of this is definitely something you can't miss for listeners out there. Well, Neil, again, thanks so much for talking with us today and for the amazing new book. I just loved it.
Yeah, thank you so much, Ken. This is such a good conversation.
Well, that's all for this episode of Jonesy here on KABU Community Radio. If you missed any part of the show or would like to hear the longer, unexpurgated version, the director's cut, you might call it, if we had a director, you can listen anytime on demand at kboo.fm/program/Jonesy, Jonesy, or just search for it on the KABU website. Before we head out the door, a big thank you to our guest today, Neil Cochran, author of the new novel, The Story of the 100 Promises, from Forest Avenue Press. Neil will be appearing live and in person at the Portland Book Festival on November 5th. You can learn more about Neil, his work, and all his upcoming events online at neilcochranbooks.com. Just a note that KABU is your community radio station, and we get over 80% of our funding from our members. To support the station and programming like this, there's no better time to become a member yourself or renew your membership. Just go to kboo.fm and click on the big donate button. All of us here at the station, even Jonesy himself, thank you for that. Jonesy, by the way, comes to you every other week on the second and fourth Thursdays of the month from 11 to 11:30 a.m. Tune in for our next show on Thursday, October 27th at 11 a.m. I'm your host, Ken Jones, no relation, saying, may you all live happily ever after.